G'day, I'm Leon Compton and welcome to the guest room at ABC Local Online. I hope you enjoy the download and don't forget you can hear the guest room live from 11 a.m. each weekday on 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 Alice Springs. If you follow the stories of Chappelle Corby, of Scott Rush, of Renee Lawrence, you'll be aware of their current address, Bali's infamous prison, Karobakan Jail. But I doubt that many of you will know what it's really like inside. Went away on holidays a week ago, driving around the Northern Territory, and was given a book by a friend that he was raving about. It's called The Hotel Karobakan, the shocking inside story of Bali's most notorious jail. And as you race through the pages, by the end of it all, you'll have a much clearer picture of some of the highs and some of the lows that are available for those imprisoned in, as the book title says, Bali's most notorious jail. The author of that tome is Catherine Bonella. She's been good enough to talk to us this morning. Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning, Leon.
And thank you for coming in and being part of the program. First up, you chose some Robbie Williams, Catherine. I think there's a connection there. You've met the man.
Yes, I think he's awesome. I was at the time I was working for 60 Minutes, I went to London with Peter Overton, and Robbie was, we had the allotted half hour with Robbie. And at that point, he'd signed a deal with Sony for $100 million and to crack the States, and he hadn't cracked the States. So he's a little bit paranoid about the interview. You know, he thought we were going to go hard on that angle, but so he was very monosyllabic in the first 5 minutes, and Pete was getting nowhere, and I was sitting there on the floor in the corner of the studio where we were filming, thinking, oh, you know, this is a nightmare. And anyway, Pete just was, he just was trying to get something out of Robbie and getting nothing, so he just asked this long, rambling, open-ended question, and at the end he stopped, and Robbie just turned around and said, what's the question? And Pete said, oh, I don't know. And Robbie just basically at that point just realised Pete was a nice bloke and opened up, and it was a fantastic interview. And he talked about a, quote, smorgasbord of Australian girlfriends he'd had. And, you know, it was actually a fantastic interview after that. But it was, yeah, he was just a great bloke. And at the end, Pete gave him a stock whip, which he often gives, you know, guests or people he interviews a little gift, and they went out and started cracking them for the camera, and it was fantastic. And Robbie was just absolutely brilliant, you know, really brilliant. So I love him.
And of course, your job as a producer on 60 Minutes is to make sure that interview goes well. Is there anything you can do once the tape starts rolling, sitting on the floor just watching it happen? Is there anything you can do to inject yourself into it to get your presenter and the talent back on the right track?
Not really. In those sort of high-profile A-list celebrity interviews, you just have to let it roll. And, I mean, you know, obviously the reporters on 60 Minutes are hugely experienced, so they're pretty good at making it happen when it's not happening. Because, you know, you often only get 20 minutes with these stars, and that's it. So, but when you're sitting there on the floor, you're just sort of sitting there with your fingers crossed, hoping like hell that it's going to go okay.
Robbie Williams, as you say, has had many an Australian girlfriend, and he's been to a lot of countries. I'm sure he has an equivalent number of girlfriends in all of they. Do you still find him sexy, Catherine?
I do. He's a naughty boy, and he's definitely sexy. Yes, I think most women do.
Look, there's been a rumour that Robbie Williams might have been looking at buying a property in the Northern Territory somewhere, maybe somewhere like Wycliffe Well. Good morning if you're listening to us in Wycliffe Well. Is there any chance you think he'll be investing here?
I don't know. He's in Sydney last week for the Arias, obviously, and he was talking about buying somewhere in Australia. So who knows? Or does he actually say that in every country he goes to win friends? I don't know. I think he likes Australia. He's been here a few times. And, you know, but it would be fantastic if he did.
Thank you for your book. I read it across the course of the holidays. A friend recommended it and recommended it most highly. And I raced through it from one end to the other. When I'd finished, I was shocked and surprised by the story of Bali's most notorious jail, the home for some number of years now to Chappelle Corby and also to the Bali Nine. It's incredible. I mean, we've talked about entertainment of one form. Take us to Karobakan Prison now. How do prisoners entertain themselves in there?
A lot of prisoners entertain themselves getting drunk and taking drugs. That's first and foremost. Every afternoon, depending on who the jail boss is at the time, you know, depends on how flexible it is. But Often in the afternoons, the prisoners will sit around in the Balinese sun, smoking joints, smoking, chasing the dragon, blowing smack into a cat's face. They called it the junkie cat, and I've got a photo of it lying flat out with a Bintang beer next to it. They just blot out reality, and there's a lot of drugs inside, and they also, the guys can play tennis, and the Bali Nine for quite a while were playing tennis, for several hours a day and just having a break in the middle of the day when it got stinking hot. But I saw Scott Rush a couple of weeks ago, and he said, just before I left Bali, and he said he'd stop doing that. That was just a little phase. And there's not much else they can do. I mean, they sit in their cells, they read, Scott was reading, they watch video DVDs, they play, PlayStation, they go to visits twice a day. They get twice a day visits, 6 days a week. And on the seventh day, it's one day. So that fills a gap for a lot of them. But there's really a lot of violence. It's a nasty, nasty place.
How is it that you came to be exposed to Kerobokan prison? What was it that took you there in the first place?
I was a producer at 60 Minutes, and I went across... When Chappelle hit the papers that first weekend of her arrest, on the Monday morning editorial meeting at 60 Minutes, I said, what about this girl in Bali? It looks like an interesting story. And they said, oh, yeah, chase it up. Do you think she's innocent? I said, oh, no idea, but she's saying she is. It's an interesting case. So from that, that was sort of the start of it. And I went and I made some phone calls. And then I flew to Bali and I met up with Mercedes and then went into the police cells and met Chappelle and said, would you be okay to do an interview for 60 Minutes? And she said yes, because that was three weeks after she was arrested, and she'd got nothing from the Australian government or from Qantas, so she was desperate. She wanted to tell Australia she was innocent. That was her reason behind doing it. So I went, Liz Hayes came over, and a cameraman and who had a little camera in his backpack, and we went to the police station. Chappelle was brought up from a concrete cell, and we sat on an old green couch, and while the lawyers distracted the cops out the door, the cameraman was pulled the camera out, and we did this sort of covert little interview with her, which was the first big interview she did, which has been seen time and time again on Australian TV. And that was the start of it. And I sort of stayed in touch with Mercedes, and then I went back with 60 Minutes with Liz Hayes for the verdict. And then at the end of that year, Mercedes asked me if I'd like to write Chappelle's book with her. So that's how it all started.
Tell me about the commitment that you had to make to write Chappelle Corby's book.
I quit 60 Minutes after 5 years working as a producer in Australia. Previously, I was working in London doing a bit of work for 60. And I moved to Bali. I had to live there because twice a day I was going into visits to see Chappelle, and then she wanted this to be really her story, her book. So she was reading every chapter and so on. So there was a big commitment, as I think there is with any sort of nonfiction. Certainly with this latest book I've done, I spent 2 years over there, in and out talking to prisoners. I mean, to get the real story, to get a real feel for it, and to be able to put it in words, sort of paint a picture, I think you need to be there the whole time and really live it. And that's what I was doing with both Chappelle's book and with Hotel Kerobokan.
You're on 105.7 ABC Darwin, 783 in Alice Springs. It's 19 past 11. My guest this morning, Catherine Bonella, the author of Hotel Kerobokan and also Chappelle, My Story. For Territorians, as you probably well know, Catherine, we have a pretty strong connection to Indonesia and to Bali. The flights are cheap for here, and sometimes it's cheaper to fly there than it is anywhere else in Australia. So we go there a lot. Amidst this part of Bali, not too far from the busiest parts of the tourist strip, this prison sits. I want to close my eyes. If it's all right with you, could you take me on a walk through the gates of Kerobokan prison? What will I find inside?
Well, outside its walls, obviously, big white walls. You've got five-star hotels and villas nearby, a beach just up the road, a beautiful beach. People go and, spend $15 on a cocktail to watch the sunset. And then you go inside those walls that touch paradise, and when you first walk in, my first time I walked in, it's extremely daunting. The guards look scary. You walk into through offices into a visiting area, and then you actually can walk out where the prisoners, the visitors aren't meant to go there, but, you know, you sling the guards some cash and you can. You walk out into the garden area, and that's part of the reason it was, I dubbed it Hotel K, because it looks a little bit like a hotel, you know, a very seedy looking hotel with grass and manicured gardens and a tennis court and a little Hindu temple. And then you walk down the pathways and you come to the cells, and they are, some of them are jam-packed. There's one particular cell that's jam-packed with up to 25 prisoners, so tightly crammed in that they can't lie down to sleep. They have to sit up against the wall. And the Australian yachtsman Chris Packer was in that cell. It's called the initiation cell, and until he paid his way out into another cell. And he did sleep through with his legs scissored through the bars so that he could stretch out a little bit. And the prisoners are regularly shooting up. There's a lot of violence. I saw some of it myself, where, you know, a guard will just come and kick a prisoner in the face. Chappelle and I were sitting together one day, and I saw one of the prisoners who was a member of the gang grab a guy by the hair and basically was about to punch him in the face until he saw us watching. I mean, the violence that goes on, it's a very violent place. Chappelle saw a man, a prisoner hanging by a sarong. I didn't see that, obviously, but I saw her that morning a little bit later, and she was totally calm. And she said, I don't know how this sort of thing's going to affect me later, but I didn't feel fazed at all. You know, she's numb to it because there is so much violence going on in that prison, particularly when there was a gang, eight top members of Bali's most vicious gang and violent gang, Laskar Bali. There was rapes, there was regular bashings. You know, it was particularly violent. And the top eight now have left, but there's still members of the gang in there and another Korean gang. So it's a but on the flip side, you can get, you know, pizza delivered to your cell by the guards. You can get, ring up your, the finest restaurant up the outside the walls, up the road, and get your favourite meal delivered. You can get a hooker delivered. You can pay to have sex in one of the guards' offices. You can have whatever drugs, a smorgasbord of drugs, you know, delivered to your cell at night. You know, it's this dichotomy of this, hellhole, but then there's these freedoms that they also have, including days out. Prisoners do get days out, and Westerners get days out, not just the locals. Although someone like Chappelle doesn't get days out because she's, you know, far too high profile and there'd be photographers everywhere.
You talk in the book about the meeting room, the place where twice a day and then once on Sundays you can meet with people who come in to see you. Describe some of the scenes that happen in this very public place at Karobar Khan Prison.
Sex. A lot of sex goes on in there.
Hang on, but my mum and dad are coming to visit me and I go to meet them in there. What, that's happening 5 metres away?
Well, it can be happening 2 metres away. I was sitting one day against a wall, and just across from me, there was a couple, fairly young couple with a little baby, and he was holding the baby strategically over his crotch, and you could see her hands sort of going up and down, and his facial expressions left nothing to the imagination of what they were actually up to, and that was literally just across. And I was actually sitting with Chappelle at that time, and I said, oh my God, are they really doing what I think they're doing? And she was just, yeah, don't look. Don't look. And then you turn around somewhere else and there's a girl straddling a guy, sort of thrusting back and forwards, but with her jeans done up. And sort of Chappelle said, her and Mercedes in the very beginning used to sit there saying, are they really, how could they be doing it? Are they doing it? And then she discovered that the girls actually in the women's section have a woman who sews trapdoors into the crotch of their jeans for easy access. So they just flip that open in the visiting room and have intercourse. And there's been many times, many of the prisoners have told me, you know, how it is a joke. There's one Dutch guy particularly who used to openly have oral sex, or his girlfriend used to go down on him all the time, and she'd get up and wipe her face, you know, look in a mirror and sort of clean her face. It happens, you know. You can't shut your eyes to it. It's right there. It happens.
What's the contrast like between life for the overseas prisoners, and it sounds like there are many in Karobar Khan, and life for the locals? Is there a difference, or is it the same?
There's a lot of Westerners, obviously, being Bali. You know, most of them are in there for drugs. They're either international drug traffickers like the Bali Nine, or they were living there as surfing there and sort of dabbling in drugs and got caught. So a lot of Europeans and South Americans, Americans. Sorry, what was your question?
Oh, well, I'm just talking to you about the dichotomy between the experience for Balinese who are put in prison there, or Indonesians, and the experience for Westerners who go in. Are they treated differently by the guards?
They are treated differently because the Westerners have money, pretty much, and also because the Westerners have consulates who can cause trouble. If, for example, when they overdose, there's regular overdoses and the locals are overdosing constantly and they don't often get taken out to hospital straight away. You know, they're left there and they either die or they get over it, whereas the Westerners get whisked out to hospital pretty quickly because, you know, they don't want the scrutiny of the consulates, you know, in and investigating it. And also, because the Westerners have money, you know, they pay the guards to work for them pretty much. You know, as I said, they pay for them to go and get them pizza. They pay for them to courier drugs in and out. They pay for a cell upgrade so that they, instead of being squashed into a cell with 25, they might have a cell with only two others. And they also can, a lot of the Westerners renovate their cells. So they, you know, will paint the walls. They'll put in a Western toilet. They, you know, make them as nice as possible. Put tiles on the floor.
What, they're tiling and adjusting the plumbing in their prison cell?
Completely, yeah. Yep. One guy built a jacuzzi just behind his cell. But the thing is, the guards, some of them are fairly business savvy, and as soon as the cell's renovated, they say to that prisoner, okay, if you want to stay in this cell, you have to pay me more money, or we move you. And if this prisoner's moved or they leave the jail, then when the next prisoner comes in, they say, you can have this cell, and they show them around like a real estate agent. You can have that cell, but you've got to pay more money. So the guards are happy to let the Westerners pay to renovate their cells. And the guy who was doing most of the renovating recently was a killer who was a professional hitman from Bali, who's Balinese, and he cut off a man's head. And he was good at renovating, so he would do all the tiling jobs. And the Aussies, one Aussie guy I know paid him $100 to tile his floor, paint his walls. So they have a much better life, for sure, the Westerners. And also because they are getting decent food. The locals who have no money basically eat the slop food that the prison provides, which is, I've seen it, they wheel around this old wooden cart full of stony hard rice. You know, it's never cooked properly. They all complain of that. With a bit of, in a big tin, metal tin, they wheel behind that, this sort of slop that's just watery stuff with cabbage leaves, sort of wilted cabbage leaves floating on the top. And that's food, that's lunch, that's dinner.
Well, but you get to eat a rat. You get to eat a rat if you catch one. I was amazed at your stories of people catching rats and eating them, in some cases raw. Oh, that sounds tough. Catherine, tell me this. Is it easier or harder to be in this jail in Bali than in an Australian one? Where would you rather do time?
Can I say neither? well, it's me personally. I think I don't know. It's a real dichotomy in Bali because you've got the, you know, filth. It's, you know, there's health issues with, you know, hepatitis, TB. Prisoners are dying in cells with TB. Scott Rush helped pull one dead guy out of a cell who had vomit and ants all over the front from, he died of tuberculosis. So there's real health issues. And I know Chappelle's family makes sure she keeps up her injections. But on the flip side to that, there is sort of freedoms, you know, in terms of the visiting. There's, you know, contact visits and you can extend those, flinging the guards a bit of cash. Whereas I haven't had a lot to do with the Australian prisons, but I did spend a bit of time in the British prisons doing stories, and I guess they're similar, you know, where you don't have, it's very strict, very controlled, but at least it's healthier. So I personally probably rather spend it in an Australian prison, but, you know, it's in Bali at least they can have days out, the odd day out at the beach, they can play tennis, they can, you know, get nice food delivered to their cell. So it's... Oh, it's a hard one.
You're on ABC Local Radio around the Northern Territory. It's coming up to almost exactly 11:30 if you're setting your watch this morning. Catherine Bonella, my guest, the author, amongst other things, of Chappelle, My Story, and Hotel Karobakam, the shocking inside story of Bali's most notorious jail. And she's certainly sharing a bit of that story with us this morning. Catherine, let's play Hotel California by the Eagles. You've chosen it because of its significance inside the prison. Tell us more.
One of the prisoners who basically has a guitar, he loves music, he writes songs, and he actually was playing his guitar loudly every night, like a madman, while his cellmate was soaring through the bars. And they actually cut every bar, glued them back in the mornings. You know, they spent weeks doing it and, you know, masking the noise with his guitar. And they reached a point where they were ready to run, and they got caught, and he got badly bashed and put in a cell. Anyway, he still has his guitar. And when he heard the name of the book, Hotel Caroubacan, he decided that he's going to write a song to the tune of Hotel California.
It's the podcast of the Northern Territory Guest Room from 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 Alice Springs.
Catherine Bonella is our guest this morning. She's written a book on what life is like inside Caroubacan Prison. Of course, it's home to not just locals, but to plenty of people from around the world, and not just Schapelle Corby and members of the Bali Nine, but other Aussies as well. Catherine, I was wondering if you could introduce us to a few of the characters that you spent a lot of time with in preparing to write this book. Who's Rogério?
He's a Brazilian surfer who had lived in Bali for several years, living the high life. He was renting out and renovating villas with Claudia Carvin's dad, actually, and had a business going, but just got into the good life too much. And his, I also met his Brazilian friends outside the jail who said he just got too blasé, and he was doing cocaine on the bar, you know, on the bars in clubs, and just overtly. And the police sort of started targeting him, and he got 9 years for possession, and he paid money to have that reduced, but instead he paid his money to the wrong person, and it went up to 11 years. So he's now doing his ninth year of 11 years, and you know, just pines for the day he can go back out surfing and go home and see his elderly mum in Brazil. And it was just, he just sort of says, you know, anyone who, it was a big mistake, you know, just dabbling in drugs, and 11 years now, you know, 9 years of his life gone.
Was he a drug dealer or just a user?
He was a user. He was a surfer. He actually would have mates coming from South America who would bring stuff in, and they'd sort of say, oh, can you hang on to this? And he'd hang on to it. So he sort of played the middleman a little bit with tiny amounts of drugs. He got done for very small amounts, but he got done as in possession of drugs and a user, not as a dealer.
Introduce,
you know.
Sorry, carry on.
I was going to say there are many international drug dealers in there from all over the world. And were you going to say introduced to a particular person?
Well, introduce us to one of those drug dealers who were leading this unreal life that you describe, where while locked up for dealing drugs, your business might in fact expand. You might become a bigger drug dealer.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Rogério was saying to me that you know, everyone in there becomes a drug dealer, all the Westerners, to make a bit of money. Because the reason that Hotel Caroubacan is such a hub for drugs in Bali, and it's the central hub, and the local press say that too, is because the police don't have jurisdiction inside the jail, and the guards only earn $100 a month. And so that on one day, working for the Westerners or working for the drug dealers taking drugs in and out, they can double their monthly salary. You know, they'll get slung $100 to take some ecstasy pills in or out, or some, you know, heroin in or out. So, you know, it's a win-win environment for the prisoners and for the guards and the police. You know, they set up outside the prison, just out the front, because they know what goes on inside. And they, you know, they basically sometimes grab someone and search them. And if they get done for drugs, if they catch someone coming out with drugs, they get a warrant, and the police can then go inside and search it. But by that time, all the prisoners have been warned by the guards on their payroll about the raids, so all the drugs are hidden. So it's a very easy place to have a drug business, a very safe place to have a drug business. And one of the biggest ecstasy dealers in Bali got caught after years of paying off the police for immunity, he actually punched a policeman, and they think, I was told that was the reason finally he lost his immunity. He went to jail, and inside the jail he set up a furniture factory, and because of that he was able to go in and out of jail whenever he wanted to. He actually had a written sort of pass to sell his furniture to the customers. But what the money-making thing was, an ecstasy factory he had behind the facade of the furniture factory, and he had prisoners making ecstasy pills for him, and he made thousands and thousands of ecstasy pills in Karobar Khan prison, and they were taken out to provide all the clubs across Kuta and Legian and Seminyak with ecstasy tablets, and they were taken out in the furniture trucks, hidden in speakers or, you know, in the furniture. And it was that's common knowledge. And the other thing too is some of the police, it's a fact that some of the police, when they confiscate the drugs off people they catch, they give it to prisoners to sell inside Karobar Khan. And there was an English guy who got caught with about 8,000 ecstasy tablets being at the post office. He'd gone to collect them. They were being sent from England for New Year's Eve. And they were confiscated. And it actually hit the papers during his court case that several hundred of them had gone missing. And one afternoon, all the prisoners were sitting around having, you know, drinking session and drug session. And he jumped up, apparently, oh, look, they're mine. And he realised that the drugs that they were selling in jail, the ecstasy tablets, were his because they had specific logos on them. And they were a particular size, and, you know, he knew they were his drugs. So that's where the missing tablets had gone.
For
the police
some people,
had confiscated them.
For some people who are in jail, having an enormous amount of their life taken from them, doing a long, long sentence, there must be a pain caused to them having been sentenced for drugs and yet seeing the system, those in authority that are their jailer, actually dealing and profiting from drugs themselves. That must be hard for some.
Absolutely. There was one particular guy who shares a cell with Scott Rush and is also on the death sentence like Scott for drugs, Emmanuel from Nigeria. And he said it sent him crazy. He's on the death sentence for trafficking drugs. And in front of his face, he said, the guards are selling drugs like coffee. His captors are selling drugs like coffee. The police, for a fact, are giving confiscated drugs to prisoners to sell inside the jail. It sent him mad. He said at night he'd wake up in hot sweats and just smash his fist into the cell wall just over and over and scream and yell, and they'd actually have to take him out. You know, he just went so mental because that hypocrisy was just driving him insane. And the other thing that was sending him crazy was, he said, the fact that he only had 300 grams of heroin when he got caught at Denpasar Airport. And there were people with, you know, far, far more who were doing 20 years, like Renee Lawrence and others in there, because he didn't have any cash, basically. And you know, just that whole hypocrisy and the corruption of the legal system was, he was suffering at the hands of it, basically.
Mm. And let's talk about that for a moment. If you were caught with a large amount of drugs, I mean, you talk about people's advice on how to deal with the justice system in Indonesia if caught, and how some people can almost skate on a major charge and others get a massive sentence for a smaller possession amount. What is your advice? What have you learnt from talking with people about the best way to handle being caught with drugs in Indonesia?
Look, the only way to get out of it is to pay, full stop. You know, you can't expect a fair trial. It doesn't happen. Even if you're innocent, you know, you have to pay. Every person I spoke to, the locals, you know, caught with ecstasy tablets, didn't have a lot of money, but their families would sell family land, or they would find the money somehow, and obviously the fee for the locals was less because they know the Westerners can pay a lot. But, you know, there's basically, when people get caught with drugs over there, even if it's just a couple of ecstasy pills, they suddenly get hit, you know, pay us $60,000, and it seems like a hell of a lot of money. And you're like, no, no, you know, and you get taken to the police cells, and several, I heard this many times. Suddenly, $60,000, when you're looking at potentially 4 years, which is a standard for any amount of ecstasy tablets, $60,000 quickly jumps if you don't pay initially. And suddenly it doesn't seem so much when you're talking about 4 years of your life or longer. But people who buck the system, people who, you know, like this, the Brazilian guy I was talking about before, he paid, but he also was very angry and screaming and yelling. And so he didn't get off. I mean, you have to play the system right. And if you do, you know, you can get out. And there's one guy who had, an English guy who had caught with 8,000 ecstasy tablets. He got in the courtroom 6 years, but because he'd paid people in the court, when they wrote his papers, which were sent to Karobakan jail, 3 years was written. So by the time he had remissions, he was out in about two.
And that's, so and that is, that's a volume of drugs for which other people have sit on death row.
That they're ecstasy. So I don't think I didn't meet anyone who was sitting on death row for ecstasy tablets. The only death row, cocaine and heroin. There were people in there on death row. But certainly he had 8,000. He was doing 3 years. The average Balinese, you know, caught with just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, doing 4 years.
Six pills in their possession would be doing 4 years to his 3 years
two tablets. Any amount of ecstasy tablets is standard 4 years. Standard. So he had 8,000 doing 3 years. You know, he paid. I mean, that's common knowledge. It's common knowledge, you know, across anyone in that jail knows it's the only way to... It's the only defence you have is to pay. The only defence.
Catherine Bonella in the guest room talking about life inside Karobakan prison in Bali. Chappelle Corby, you spent an incredible amount of time with the writing of your book, Chappelle, My Story. How is she travelling at the moment?
She's on huge amounts of medication, and it's the only thing keeping her sort of balanced. But she's really, really struggling. I saw her probably three, four weeks ago now, and at the end of the, as I was leaving, she just burst into tears, highly emotional, and she said, "Look at my legs." And she pulled up her jeans, and she had on her knees a whole lot of cuts. And she said it was from the medication thinning out her skin. And when she got down to change the sheet on her mattress, her legs cut, you know. And she's had a big mark on her face, which she said was a pimple she'd scratched. It was a big scab and sore. So she certainly doesn't look the well-groomed, you know, Chappelle that she was even just, you know, a year ago. She's really struggling.
And so what would you like to see happen from here for her? Can any more be done?
Ideally, will anything be done?
Or can any more be done in terms of giving her better access to healthcare? Can she be brought back to Australia to serve time here? I mean, what's the best thing for her now, in your view?
In my view, obviously being released would be the very, very best thing. That's not likely to happen in any time soon. So I guess if she was put in a cell by herself and, you know, given a little bit more hygiene in that prison, or taken out to a mental health facility there is a jail that, you know, has proper mental health, that would probably be helpful. And that's not too far away. That's in Bangli, which is like an hour from where her family live in Kuta.
How is she treated? How is she treated in prison?
She's treated okay. You know, she's sort of, she feels like she has a bad deal because she is so high profile, and things like, you know, power, most cells have PowerPoints. Often hers is blocked up. You know, because when people come in to visit the jail, you know, they let university students go in, and that she's always the one that they go and watch, like a, you know, exhibit it in the zoo. So they don't want to look like she's getting special treatment. So she actually gets less, I think, you know, benefits than a lot of the other prisoners. She's okay. I mean, she's lucky because she's got such a supportive family. Without that, I think, you know, she's already slashed her wrist twice. I think she'd be gone by now if she didn't have her sister Mercedes, you know, going in virtually every day, taking her medication and taking her food and so on. And that really is the only thing that's keeping her going at this stage.
As I said to you earlier, Territorians go to Bali in droves. Karobakan prison is not far from the thick of the tourist action. Should people allocate some time to going and visiting somebody while they're there?
Well, the Australians are hard to visit these days because, you know, there was such a throng of people going in, busloads of tourists in the past. The prison's actually now got a list of people who are allowed to go in and visit. There's always ways around that in Bali, you know, by slinging a bit of cash, but it is more difficult to get in. So, you know, if people wanted to do something, they could always, you know, drop something off at the jail, like a care package or something, is probably the best thing they could do.
Do you believe that Chappelle Corby is innocent or guilty?
I believe firmly that she is innocent.
And the courts...
I didn't always.
Mm-hmm. The courts
I didn't always. No, well, the courts are a joke. You know, they are a serious joke. I mean, they didn't accept any of the testimony of any of her witnesses, you know, people who travelled with her. They refused to fingerprint the bag. She said, my fingerprints aren't on the plastic bag. Fingerprint it, and she begged them to. They didn't. There was CCTV monitors at the airport overlooking customs. She said, please, can we access that? And you'll see that I willingly opened my bag. They didn't do that. I mean, she didn't get stand a chance in the courtroom to prove her innocence. She didn't get x-ray, you know, luggage x-rays from Qantas. She had nothing. She had absolutely nothing to prove her innocence.
Mm. How's Scott Rush going? I mean, he's another high-profile case being represented by Colin McDonald, amongst others, QC, a Territorian. How's Scott Rush going as a member of the Bali Nine?
Scott seemed... I saw Scott on the day I left about 3 weeks ago, and he seemed remarkably good. I've seen him... I've met him many, many times in there, and I've seen him when he's been really down and not so good, dark circles under his eyes. But he actually looked... He said he'd sort of withdrawn a lot from prison life. He just spent his days now in his cell reading good books, and he was sort of fairly philosophical and fairly hopeful for the future. He's got an appeal coming up. I mean, it's been coming up now for 18 months, so I'm not sure when it's actually going to happen, his final appeal. But for someone on death row, he was amazingly upbeat. And, you know, he's actually a smart, articulate guy and, you know, very, very, very regretful what he did when he was 19. He's now 24, 25 this month. And, you know, biggest mistake, obviously, of his life, and which will potentially take his life.
I always wonder how the Australian Federal Police feel looking at that case and the way that they decided to handle it as to whether they might have done something different if they had their time again. People will remember, of course, that Scott Rush's father feared that his son was about to do something stupid and called the AFP and said, look, I think my son's about to get involved in couriering drugs internationally. Can you stop him at the airport on the way out of town? They chose a different path. He's in Kerobokan prison on what death row as we speak.
Mm.
What's next for you, Catherine?
I'm not sure. I literally, you know, got back 3 weeks ago from the last 2 years in Bali. So, you know, maybe I'll do another book. Maybe I'll do some freelancing for 60 Minutes. I'm not sure at this stage.
It's been great.
Take Christmas.
Well, enjoy your Christmas. It's been great to have you as part of the guest room. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
This has been the Northern Territory Guest Room. Listen live each weekday from 11 a.m. Territory time or go to abc.net.au/Darwin or /Alice Springs to hear more.